My hope is that this won't really be a lecture, but more of like a conversation. And so we'll just like.
Which is a lecture. You can't just speak so.
So I haven't done anything on. I haven't done any real work on evolution. So I'm not going to tell you about anything I've done. And so this is more going to be talking about stuff which other people have figured out. Or looked at, and talking about, you know, different. I mean, mostly what I'm going to talk about is different aspects of spindle assembly and spindles and different organisms. So first, I'll just kind of say my background and motivation, and that is that. So, you know, I'm trained as a physicist, and you know, I'm working on cell biology, and I guess like for me, the type of thing which sort of always like really excited me is biological self-organization, in particular, you know, like things like these subcellular structures in biology, which are high dynamic, steady state structures, stuff like the spindle, or a lot of organelles, or even like mitochondrial networks and stuff like that. And so, I mean, that's, you know, I don't know, like the type of thing which often like. Keeps me up at night, you know, thinking about these systems and how to understand them from a more physical point of view. And I started my own lab at Harvard about a year ago, and that's mostly what the lab is focusing on, is trying to do these kind of, I don't know, like physical cell biology type measurements, and you know, again, with a focus on understanding the spindle. But when I came to Harvard and started studying my lab, I started to talk with a number of people who think about evolution. And it got me wondering, you know, all this kind of self-organization stuff, which I think is so, you know, fascinating and amazing, like, in some sense, does it really matter at all? I mean, like, is it important? Or, like, what aspects are important? And so that got me thinking about, again, these evolutionary questions some more. And so, for me, can I go on? Okay. So for me, like my personal motivation for thinking about this stuff, or my first motivation for starting to think about this stuff, is to really try to think about what aspects of spindle self-organization are really biologically important. So for example, I mean, again, like a lot of what the lab is focused on is really understanding microtubule dynamics in spindles and how this gives rise to spindle structure. But does the actual shape of the spindle really matter? I mean, is it the length of the spindle which is important, or not? And so, like, it seems to me that like the real way to answer those questions is through some type of evolutionary approach. And so, like, for me, like, what the dream thing is to really, you know, combine, you know, this type of like physical cell biology with real like evolutionary biology, you know, like population genetics and comparative biology. And so that was my motivation for starting to read about this stuff and think about it. But then, like, as I don't know, began to think about stuff more, you know, I realized that, of course, are much more interesting questions. And so, like, you know, so I would say in addition to this, like, primary motivation, I mean, other things is just kind of the more general question of the fact that there are all these spindles out there which act differently, and how can we explain this biodiversity which, you know, exists in nature, the different organization dynamics of this of spindles, and then also again just kind of another type of more broad question is just, I mean, how to think about evolution of these type of self-organizing structures like the spindle. Okay, so like I said, so I can't really tell you about this, but I can tell you about other stuff. And so now I'll tell you about other stuff. All right, so you know, like if you look at kind of a standard cell bio textbook, and so I'm just kind of, a large part of what I'm going to be saying today is basically an elaboration and stuff which Zach and Tarun talked about before. But this is kind of going into more details on certain aspects of things and stuff like that. So just to make sure we're on the same page, I'm just going to go over the, you know, basic stuff. So if you look at a kind of textbook description of mitosis, you know, you'll see the following type of description. So, you know, the typical, human tissue culture cell. You have a nucleus which breaks down, you know, spindle forms in prometaphase. In metaphase, you have all the chromosomes aligned on the metaphase plate. And then in anaphase, chromosomes become segregated. And in cytokinesis, you actually cleave into two daughter cells. So this is kind of the general, you know, like outline. Just to show you that this really happens. this is a fabulous movie from Pat Wadsworth's lab, which I just stole from online, of GFP labeled tubulin in a pig tissue culture cell. So you can see, well, this is a metaphase, and then anaphase. Okay, so I'm going to show.
Stop this just at the very last frame.
probably not. Yeah, is that the last frame? Oh, you're challenging. We might be here like all day if I.
There is some filament forming right in the middle. So.
Oh, right there.
Yes.
Oh, I see. That's
it.
Yeah. That's a spindle midbody, which is partly the old central spindle, but also some new stuff. And then they have, and they transport vesicles in the middle, and they seal off. If you disrupt that, you can pinch down, but it can expand again. It's literally at the very end, this vesicle crack makes the stem corver, the midbody. And what happens is that the cells in culture eventually, they'll move around, and like mechanical force, it will snap and break it. And one cell enters the midbody, and the other will not. But it's required to completely seal off the cleavage growth.
Actually, one of the centrioles goes to check whether everything is okay, and then it breaks.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
It depends on the cell, but that's the that's been described. Yeah.
But I guess notice some similar structure in fly embryo, like without cell wall, right? So in the syncytia.
That's right.
So,
well, you have the spindle element, but you don't have to. It depends on whether you're going through cytokinesis. So you have the central spindle after it slides. You have a bundle of microtubules that are rather stable in the middle. It's left over. And so in this case, it's used to make this structure. But I think in the fly in the syncytial stage, you don't need to do that. I don't know what its fate is, but it hangs on.
Sorry.
Conversation. Alright, so I'm going to show another movie of the same thing, taken not with fluorescence, but phase contrast. And this particular movie is really cool, and it illustrates another aspect of this process. So, so this is from a frog cell, also in tissue culture. Okay, sorry, wait, I like this one a lot, so I'm going to bring up another talk which has this one because it illustrates one thing, which is very cool. Pardon me. Sorry, this is. Okay. So here we have the nucleus. Here's the cell. And so what you have first, and so here your nucleus is intact. First thing you can see is the chromosomes start to condense. And now we can see the actual chromosomes. And now we're in prometaphase, and the spindle's starting to form. And now what you see is that some chromosomes haven't made it to the plate yet. And the spindle is sitting here like trying to capture this guy. And it waits around and like tries to get him. And then it eventually gets it, and now you're in metaphase. And then you go into anaphase. And so the thing which this demonstrates is this checkpoint which is present. And so the cell knows that there was this one chromosome which was way off, and it knew not to divide until the chromosome, you know, becomes properly oriented, and then it can go on. Okay? It's really amazing that this works. But another thing which is really amazing about it, and this is starting to think about evolution, so biology stuff, is that, I mean, how important this is or is not. I would naively think that the checkpoint is crucially important, and like without the checkpoint, it should be really, really bad. And it ends up it's kind of more complicated than that. It seems that you can have flies, which you basically destroyed MAD2, which is one of the proteins important for a checkpoint, and it doesn't seem to be that much of a problem. And also in C. elegans, it's not clear if there's no checkpoint or just a very weak checkpoint, but certainly, again, if you get rid of checkpoint proteins, C. elegans is fine until it goes into this dour stage and it has problems going out. On the other hand, for mice, if you get rid of checkpoint, then they're totally screwed. They'll, get cancer and die, I don't know when, but, it's very, very bad. Another point which is really interesting is that in a lot of early embryos, for example, the checkpoint is not active. So one can certainly think of rationales for why this might be the case, but at least like my intuition would be my most naive one would be the exact opposite, that this is kind of the most important time to have a checkpoint. I'll just say one thing which I think is perhaps interesting and telling is that in many embryos, the checkpoint starts becoming active at the mid-blastula transition, which is a time, and so like before this, basically all the protein in the cell is stuff which has come from mom, and at the mid-blastula transition, that's when you start getting stuff from the child. Yeah, sorry, that's what I was looking for. Protein synthesis, exactly. And that's it seems in many organisms when the checkpoint starts becoming active.
So is there any measurement of how many times it fails in embryos without the checkpoint?
Okay, so this is an incredibly interesting question, I think. In embryos, you could also ask, another thing which isn't obvious to me at all, is that, in your body, in some sense, how important is it? Because you can imagine on one hand, cancers can be caused by errors in cell division, right? So you think it's very, very important to do this very correctly. But on the other hand, you could justify it that if you're in some random tissue in your body, and you have some missegregation, then maybe other cells can just kill that cell, and so it doesn't matter so much. And so, I don't know of any good measurements. This isn't my area, but I don't know of good measurements about these things.
Is the argument in embryo development that the cells need to divide so rapidly that you can't afford to have a checkpoint?
So this is what I've heard people say, yeah.
In the syncytial stage, the entire cell cycle is 6 minutes. Mm-hmm. And there's basically no G1 and G2,
it's basically the best, and the best. Sorry, so I guess to go back to this question, in species where you have, where you checkpoint, but still the molecules are here, you can measure how many times you have defects, errors.
That would be incredibly, Right.
You have this syncytial stage and you go through all these cell divisions, then you go through cellularization. And anything that's wrong, they just shove the cells into the interior and kill them off. I don't know whether that's a general strategy, but that's apoptotic. I don't know how they send.
So you're setting
this is a Drosophila embryo. These early stages that are so fast, basically, once they become cellularized, the cells that are cells start to migrate and do various things. And if you have a cell that's somehow dysfunctional, I can't define that, but I know that they don't migrate into the interior and kill them off.
The nucleus, really, dysfunctional nucleus, right? So I think
this is like the 6,000 cell stage or whatever before you start.
There's a surprising variability in the number of nuclei, right? At the stage that you soluble to the 13.
That's right.
It varies by 15% or something.
I'm going to guess that, given that fact too, that what's more important is just to have a lot of cells.
then you start worrying about the quality, and you have a quality control mechanism. And then when you really worry about quality is when they start to differentiate, and each cell division is very precious because the daughters are the
least. But luckily, it's a very particular embryo when it divides.
That's right, it's very...
It's a very derived variant of any direction, still living from one embryo. So if you look at the other animals, I mean...
I don't know.
I don't know about the arrows there, but...
What's the selection pressure for fast-growing embryo? Okay, so there's protein degradation before research.
So these stages that we're talking about are all maternal. It's all driven by maternal stuff. There's no, it's the stage 13, is it? Then when the maternal, the embryonic programs and everything kicks in.
So you think actually there's some kind of training from the mother actually to play the role of
you would have to at that early stage.
But, and so during this stage, I mean, there's no transmission of any signals or proteins between the embryo and the mother. It's just a bag of stuff. And
I don't know that. No, I would assume so. Yeah.
Okay.
They're laid, right?
Okay.
Encapsulated. Yeah. It's not like this is happening in the mother at
yeah.
all.
Okay.
It's not like
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But.
Yeah. In the flurry of discussion, I may have missed it, but what's the actual, you were talking about fly embryos and you were talking about tissues. In both cases, you said that there's some impetus maybe that cells that are incorrectly divided will be killed off. And so what was the signal that actually tells anybody else? Like, if I'm not wearing underwear, no one knows. Sincerely.
Oh, I know.
So I'm just trying to like ask how they determine that something is wrong with any of these other cells, especially as it's early stages.
I don't know, certainly. People may not, yeah, no.
What about single cells? Single cell checkpoints?
Checkpoints.
Yeah. I mean, yeast certainly has checkpoints, yeah.
And those are in white, they always have checkpoints.
This I don't know.
Yes.
Okay, all right. So the metaphase spindle. All right, so the kind of like, again, textbook view of metaphase spindle is thing like the following. So you have this kind of football-shaped structure, chromosomes in the middle, you have centrosomes at the poles, or which are the poles, depending on how you look at it, or which textbook you look at, I guess. and then you have, essentially, people often describe kind of three classes of microtubules. And so one would be astral microtubules, which radiate out, and these would be the microtubules interacting with the cortex involved in positioning the spindle. Then there's microtubules which contact chromosomes on a special region called the kinetochore, and these microtubules are thought to be involved both with kind of positioning chromosomes and also signaling this checkpoint that everything's okay. And then you have the non-kinetochore microtubules, which really make the body of the spindle. And that's what gives you bipolarity. Maybe that depends on the system, but you also have these non-kinetochore microtubules, which in some sense make up the body of the spindle.
Yeah. How long is the cell willing to wait before it says, screw it, I'm going to kill myself? In other words, something happens, something gets stuck somewhere and it can't get to the face plate. So how long, what's the clock, or is there a clock that says, okay, like when I go online and it says you're timed out and it's just a terrible page, what is the clock, or is there a clock, and how does it know when to get
there? Oftentimes, there is the types of experiments that are done are like you treat a cell with colchicine, right? Uh-huh. And so what happens is that the spindle disappears, right? The microtubules are depolymerized, the chromosomes are doubled, nuclear envelope can even break down, but eventually it will reform, and you'll go back to being a cell that now is tetraploid rather than diploid, right? And so I know in sea urchins, in tissue culture cells, eventually that will happen. several hours or something like that.
In human tissue culture cells, it depends strongly on the type of cell, and this is very important for cancer research, and also depends on what the perturbation is. And so, like, if you throw on, like, Taxol and you arrest cells that way, it's different than if you throw on some other drug and arrest cells. And so, I mean, again, like, you know, there's a, obviously this is a, you know, because it's really the cancer, it's very important, but, like, I don't know about it.
So what's the clock that actually measures, like, when it, it's like, okay.
I don't think that's known.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, and so again, another thing, and again, this is the thing which personally gets me most excited, but like, you know, the important to realize is that the spindle at any stage, but even in the metaphase stage, when you're in steady state, the spindle is highly, highly dynamic. And so there are kind of like classically at least, you know, two types of dynamics which people often describe. And now we're thinking of just the microtubules which are making the body of the spindle. And so again, remember, we're in metaphase, so the spindle itself is not changing, but this is the dynamics which are occurring even though you're at steady state. And so one type of thing which is happening is that you have what's called poleward flux. So the spindle is a constant length, right? And so what was done in this experiment by Tim Mitchison was that, so he has a dye which when you shine, so the dye is normally dark. When you shine light on it, the dye becomes fluorescent. Okay, so you have a dark spindle. You shine light on it. You have fluorescent tubulin. Over time, what happens is that this bar you created splits into two because the tubulin here is migrating toward the poles. Okay, so even though constant length, you have this continual migration toward the poles. And not only is this continual movement, this flux, there's also incredibly rapid turnover. And so, I don't know, like again, like so we do kind of like experiments on in vitro assembled spindles. And there you can have spindles which are literally stable for hours, despite the fact that the turnover of microtubules is of order 20 seconds. And so it's like incredibly, incredibly dynamic. Okay, and so even though, I mean, at least the way the way most people think of spindle, the spindle is basically microtubules, but there are all these huge number of proteins which regulate the activity and behavior of microtubules. And so we're not going to get into any names, but just kind of general classes of proteins which are present. Is there motor proteins which slide microtubules relative to each other? You know, there are guys which slide anti-parallel microtubules apart. There are guys who slide parallel microtubules. There are a bunch of different cross-linkers. And there are proteins which nucleate microtubules, and ones which stabilize them, and ones which destabilize them. And somehow all this stuff acting together magically gives you the spindle.
Yeah, do the stabilizers actually just act locally on the end caps to prevent dynamic instability, or do they change the GTPase rate?
And so there are different classes of, I guess, stabilizers and destabilizers, which act in different ways. And so, for example, some destabilizers are thought to be involved with kind of, you know, like, I actually don't know the details of exactly how this is supposed to work because I don't know the most recent stuff, but like, there's one of these actually like a kinesin, it's actually a kinesin protein, but it doesn't walk on microtubules, it actually depolymerizes them. So certainly one model of how that works is it somehow is involved in inducing the conformational change which kind of destabilizes microtubules, but I don't know the details of kind of the you know, chemistry of that. So that's kind of standard textbook stuff. And so now I'm just going to talk about variations in various different aspects of different things. So I'm going to go over, so just the overview, I'm going to talk about both essentially nuclear envelope breakdown, stuff at the poles, and then microtubules. And so because Zach and Tarun, you know, talked about nuclear envelope breakdown and pole stuff before, I'm going to go through that relatively quickly and spend most of the time talking about microtubules. But just to remind you guys, or people that mentioned other two talks, so there's a lot of variation in the extent of nuclear envelope breakdown which happens. And so classically, people classified, or some people classify, nuclear envelope, a mitosis into being open or closed. And so in a classical kind of open mitosis, which is like, again, happens in human tissue culture cells, you have basically total nuclear envelope breakdown, and the spindle is just, you know, like, I don't know, it's just there. in kind of classic, you know, total closed mitosis, you have the spindle inside the nucleus. And so, for example, yeast is a classic example of this. And I guess it would be a picture like this. And so you have the nucleus and the spindle's just inside. But there's basically, you know, there's a huge variety of other variations which exist. And so you can have various amounts of nuclear envelope breakdown and various other things entirely. And so, I mean, like you know, I don't know, like one type of things which one can have is you can have essentially, you know, breakdown nucleus preferentially around the poles. And you have maybe like kind of the poles more or less outside, kind of protruding microtubules in. But there's a huge amount of other things. And so kind of two things which are very cool, which were both mentioned previously, but I'm just, Oh, right. And it's also somewhat more complicated. And so again, in some organisms, for example, these guys, you can have both closed and open divisions depending on, I don't know, like what's going on in this life. Okay. But again, like I said, so just kind of illustration of like other things which can happen. These are kind of two cool examples. So one is that in dinoflagellates, you in some sense don't have the classic kind of spindle looking type thing at all. And so basically you have a nucleus with kind of two, you know, with microtubule bundles going through, and chromosomes can kind of hang on to these bundles and divide. And another really cool guy is these ones, in which case what you have, and I'll just show some pictures of this because I think this is so amazing. And so what you have is really basically a spindle assembles outside the nucleus, and the nucleus kind of, you know, more or less attaches on, and the chromosomes get divided. And so, like, here's just kind of pictures of these cells, just because I'd heard about this, and then I actually saw the pictures, and I was like, wow, that's cool. So here's a huge, here's one of these cells, and this is 10 microns, so these guys are gigantic. And on the same scale, so here's actually a spindle in polarized light microscopy, which would, I guess, assemble more or less up here. And then this is a nucleus, which will eventually become attached to that. So a lot of cool stuff.
That's the macronucleus?
No. Which is in a it's in the same group of Trichomonas. So this is in a hindgut of a termite or Lydian cockroach.
Yeah.
And the cells are like 150 microns in size, and you can trigger them to divide when the cockroach goes through its molt.
Yeah, so reading, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of amazing that they were able to do like live cell imaging because these guys are anaerobic, and so I don't know. Okay. So that was just kind of, you know, very briefly going over nuclear envelope stuff, and so now I'm going to very briefly go over pole stuff. So remember we have the spindle, we have the poles, and there's a huge amount of variation about essentially what's going on at spindle poles. For example, kind of. And I'm not saying this is some like great classifying scheme, but I'm just saying three, you know, options, right? And so one is that, you know, like one has centriole, the poles, and this is what we normally think of because we have centrioles at our spindle poles, or some of our spindle poles. There are many organisms which have something there, but it's not a centriole. In yeast, this is called like spindle pole bodies, and these are kind of centers which, in this case, are nucleating microtubules. And there are other structures which can be present there. And then some spindles don't have anything in particular, they don't have any particular kind of special static structure there. And so in these cases, the pole is really self-organized. This is true in, for example, female meiotic spindles in like, many metazoans. Plants. And plants as well, I guess. I mean, I don't.
Not really.
Yeah, I don't know what's. Well, so one example that I want to show this is really self-organized. So this is an experiment. This is actually done in an extract. So I'll just kind of briefly mention this again later because I work on this and it's also cool. It ends up that one can assemble spindles basically in frog egg extracts. Which are essentially the same as the second meiotic spindle. So when you do that, you can follow the spindle, do all type of perturbation. So you can have a regular spindle, which has real poles, and there are proteins which are preferentially localized to these poles. But then you can go in and just physically like cut the poles off. And then over time, the spindle will heal itself. It'll grow back, and all the proteins will be localized to the right place. So it's really a self-organized thing.
This is just a general knowledge. This is maybe just a general knowledge question, but you know, you take an extract out in vitro and have it reassembled. What triggers it to start forming, you know, behaving like it's dividing?
Yeah, and so like what you need to to make it divide, go on later?
To make it look like a spindle.
Oh, to make it look like a spindle. And so basically like in this system, I'll mention this again in a second, but essentially the gist of it is that so like in the frog egg, that you know like it's arrested in meiosis two, so there's a little spindle there, and the cytoplasm thinks it's in meiosis two. And so if you kind of purify out the cytoplasm, and then add DNA, which has picked up the right components, you know, kind of like factors associated with it, then that can trigger spindle assembly. And it doesn't matter what the DNA is. And so like there's these fabulous experiments where people have, you can take magnetic beads, cut it with lambda phage DNA, and you get spindles to assemble, which are essentially identical to what you have in the frog.
But to answer your question more specifically, that extract is purified for something with active CDK and cyclin B. You can also get extracts that are interphase in nature where the CDK or cyclin B is inactive, and you can oscillate back and forth just by changing the calcium levels. And if you're in the CDK or calcium, you can actually get a spindle to form and then remove the calcium or some other way by adding genetically modified something or other that would put it back in the G1 S phase type regulation, and you, if it wouldn't form, you actually form a nucleus.
Okay, right. And so not only is there variation in you know the existence of what's at the poles, but there's also variation kind of the importance of what's there. And so, for example, just thinking of centrioles. And so you know, so like, all right. So like I said before, like so one option is that you know like okay so like. In you know whatever female meiosis there's not going to be centrioles, and so clearly in that particular spindle, I mean they're not normally present and they're not important because they're not there. But there are also many cases where centrioles are present but they are not very important. And so kind of illustrations of that. So if you take mammalian tissue culture cells and you laser ablate the centrioles, so you can blow them up, the spindles are basically fine. And so it's really not much effect at all. And you can even make Drosophila, and again this was mentioned previously, which basically don't have functioning centrioles. And there's essentially subtle spindle phenotypes. But again, that's not universally true. And so it seems, for example, in like C. elegans, in the first mitotic spindle, their centrioles are hugely important, and essentially all the microtubules are nucleated from the centrioles. Okay, so now, yeah, so microtubules. Okay, so first thing is, again, like I was saying, so spindles can have different shapes and sizes. Just to illustrate what I was talking about before, so like, you know, this is a spindle from a frog egg extract, which is more or less like having the frog. You have this very large football-shaped structure. Here's a spindle from a human tissue culture cell, which is basically a sphere. Spindle from a Drosophila tissue culture cell, where it's a nice triangulated thing. And spindle from yeast, where it's small.
How variable is it within, for example, the extracts? Is it always the same size or
different? And the extracts aren't a great example, because they're kind of experimental artifacts, due to the fact that it's an extract. And like, you know, maybe you didn't prepare your extract perfectly, and so there's variation. But I do not know, like, if you look in kind of a real organism and really look at like the exact same, you know, tissue, you know, the exact same, you know, same spindles, how what the variability is. I actually don't know about that.
How much does this has to do with like adhesion boundary effects of the cell? Like, so I know S2 cells, you know, stay attached when they divide.
Right.
T1 cells if they attach, and then most human tissue culture cells attach. Right? Does that affect the size of the tissue?
And so certainly, like, you know, like if the spindle is squished, it can change shape and stuff like that. I mean, like, you know, like as of now, since I'm just being, you know, like theory free and just being like, hey, look, you know, if you look under the microscope, you see these different things. I mean, like, it's certainly true. It certainly is not the case that it's like, if you had a Xenopus, again, I haven't done the experiment, but I'm sure if you had a Xenopus extract spindle and you kind of squish it really small, you'd end up with a yeast spindle. You know, that seems very unlikely. That, you know, I mean, there must really be some differences there. But to like what extent, it's a question of kind of the biochemistry of the different processes. I mean, this is kind of like a thing which I think is really interesting, is that again, like, if you think about like some, you know, from an evolution point of view, like selection on, and this is a partly related question, but like if you imagine that like it was really important to have a spindle of some particular size and shape, it's not obvious that the way you would do that was actually modifying a set of skeletal proteins or something like that. You could imagine that like if the, you know, mom laid the egg slightly differently, then maybe that would, you know, exactly, you could say have some changing boundary condition that would give you rise to a different spindle structure, right?
Have anybody done like patterning on different geometries and seeing if the spindle structure changes shape on the same cell type?
And so people have done, well, like I said, squishing on cells and seeing how that changes. And so definitely, you know, you like if you squish cells, if you squish spindles, and they elongate and stuff like that. I think all the patterning work I'm aware of isn't kind of super adhesive, and so I don't know like how much you're really kind of, you know, changing the shape of the you know, really confining the spindle with that type of stuff.
Well, in the Xenopus too, they prepared extracts from two different species.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah.
One is polyploid, one is tetraploid, and the spindles are of different sizes, and they're now using that to isolate what might be the differences.
Yeah.
And so there is some variation, but
well, that's between organs.
Drosophila, if you look at the syncytial sage and you look at one of those films, they all look exactly the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so this is, you know, again, so it's not, so relatively close related organisms can have different spindles. And so here are two sea urchins, which both have an S in front of their name. And so like one has a much larger egg than the other one. And again, you can see spindles are different morphologies, right? And so these are kind of relatively.
That means extract experiments, if you just mix up different cytoplasms, what happens?
Okay, so I'll just mention extract now because I was about to talk about the Rebecca Heald paper, just kind of to illustrate the same thing. So like, just to, again, so I already said this, but I'll just show it again because as opposed to a frog. All right, so this is the extract process, just to explain again, like I was saying before, you have a frog, you make it lay eggs, and you have many eggs. And often in practice when you do this, you get eggs from different frogs and you mix them up so you have even more. And then you essentially centrifuge them, and then you isolate out the cytoplasmic layer, and then again, like I said, if you add DNA which has been incubated with the right factors, then it will assemble spindles which are the same, right? And so okay, so then I'll just get to one other thing, and then I'll just like kind of just show the Rebecca Heald's work, which is that basically, okay, so most people do these experiments with Xenopus laevis, but it ends out that you can also make extracts out of Xenopus tropicalis eggs, and so if you look, compare Xenopus tropicalis to Xenopus laevis, so tropicalis has smaller eggs, about half the diameter. And the genome is about half the size because there was a doubling event, in this guy's past. And so like if you just literally kind of like take the extract from this guy, you get smaller spindles than the extract from the laevis, which people typically used. And so the thing which is one of the results which is incredibly cool is that so now you have these two extracts. And so then what Rebecca Heald's group did is that they like mix the two extracts together, right? And so then if you can have 50-50, and then you have a spindle which is like halfway in between.
So laevis is tetraploid?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. It's a pseudo tetraploid.
Then what's the blue and the black are?
Oh, okay. This is a little bit of a complication stuff. And so, okay. So I can explain it. But like, basically, so they did this. So they wanted to know, are the factors present? Okay, so there's some factors which give you different size, right? And then I know, is this thing having to do with the chromosomes which you're using? Because they in this particular experiment, they made these spindles using essentially demembranated frog sperm of the corresponding species. And they want to know, are the factors which determine spindle size associated with the DNA in the sperm, or is it associated with the cytoplasm? And so what you can do is that you can just mix stuff up and do stuff in different ways. And basically what the end result is that essentially the size of the spindle you get is very weakly dependent on the amount of DNA. And so like if you double the amount of DNA, then I forget exactly the numbers, but it's something like a we'll hear some numbers. So I mean, like, if you have pure Laevis extract, if you have pure Tropicalis extract, and then you can either use Laevis sperm or Tropicalis sperm, and so this is essentially doubling the amount of DNA, the corresponding change in spindle length is very, very small. And it ends up that if you just use so this is probably just bulk DNA. I mean, because people have done experiments where they've just changed the amount of DNA, nothing to do with other factors.
So I'm sure that this is being checked, but these are averages. Is it a unimodal distribution of spindle sizes when you mix the extract?
Yes, and so I don't know the answer to that. I would assume that it's a relatively broad distribution, because extract can be a little bit finicky and stuff like that, and they probably threw out like bad spindles, and so But but like, given those caveats, I mean my guess is that it's not bimodal.
And but I don't know. DNA bumping, but the size of the condensed chromosomes in the natural context, how does that vary between Tropicalis and?
I'm sorry,
the actual condensed chromosome.
So you that they'd be the same size. Because you have twice as many.
Oh, I see.
I can't swear, but that's what I'm thinking of.
And so again, I mean, the point is that, or not the point, but one of the interesting things is that, these closely related species can have different spindles. But it's also important to realize that also, it's not just different species. It's like different kind of tissues or different, cell stages within the same organisms can have very different spindles. And so the light's not great here, but like, one of the largest differences is between meiotic spindles and mitotic spindles. It's true that, I'm going to talk about this in a second, but different mitotic spindles are also different. But like, so here, this is, you can see this is a Laevis egg right here, and here's this is the spindle, and so if you zoom in the myotic spindle, this is what you see, and so this is the second division, and so here's the whole egg here, and then if you zoom in on this spindle, here's what you see, and so it's whatever, a different morphology. And a very similar thing, one has in C. elegans. So if you look at, here's a C. elegans guy, and so here's a typical meiotic spindle. And if you look at the first mitotic spindle, right, which is just right away, it's totally different morphology. And like I was saying, so it's not just meiotic versus mitotic. Even different mitotic spindles have different sizes and shapes. And so in this one study, Martin Werg, who's a grad student in Tim Mitchison's lab, looked at spindles at different stages during early development in Laevis. And so you can see right here from this picture that this is the second mitotic spindle. Here's one from the seventh. Here's one from a later stage. It looks like spindles are kind of getting smaller and smaller. And in fact, like if you just make a graph of you look at all these different stages, from the second meiotic spindle up to stage 9, and you plot the spindle length versus cell diameter, you get a plot like the following. And so, the spindle length is, well, mitotic spindles are smaller, then first mitotic spindles are around, have a length around 50 microns, and they keep on being around 50 microns, until you get to small enough cells, in which case the size starts getting smaller and smaller. And so the mechanism behind this is totally unclear. So for example, you could imagine two kind of different classes of models. One class of model would be that it's kind of, it's really like the cytoplasm is more or less the same the whole time, but somehow you're just confining the spindle, and therefore it's getting smaller and smaller. Or you could imagine that you really have kind of, you know, I mean, different cells are different, and there's really some altered biochemistry going on. And therefore, right, and therefore, like, yeah, this thing's really different, and that's why the spindle is smaller. Yeah. That's right. Well, it's interesting. Well, sort of, but like, why should it be anything? I mean, like, why should it be linear? Why should it be? Or like, I mean, like, so clearly this is the same DNA, right? The whole time, it's the same amount of DNA. I mean, these tiny spindles can do a perfectly good job of dividing the DNA. I mean, like, you know, like, why are these spindles larger, right?
No, but if it's confinement,
it could be once you start, you know, like if it's really big, you know, because you know these things are massive, right? You know, 1,400 microns. Maybe it doesn't feel the edges until it's small or something.
It might be fruitless, but are there any geometrically conserved quantities? I mean, these are like geometric objects, like so they have like, within a species or in between species. I'm saying like these are triangles and they have different shapes, whatever, and there are aspects of those shapes that seem to be well conserved across, for instance, on this plot or even on larger.
No, I think these are really cool questions. No one's looked. So no one's looked. Like, is there any pattern?
Like, what is the cell? What's the operating conservation laws?
Right. No. Exactly. I mean, I think those are really interesting questions. Right. Exactly. But no one's really looked. Or if they look, they haven't published it.
Are the meiotic spindles on that, or is this all meiosis
ones? It's just meiosis too.
So there's a big difference already.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to go back to establishing bipolarity, in meiosis, you don't have, it's the nuclear envelope breaks down, at least in meiosis one, and then you self-organize, the chromosomes play a direct role in self-organizing the bipolar array. And the spindle poles are rather broad. Whereas in all the mitotic ones, I believe in Xenopus, although it's not true in mouse, but all the mitotic ones, you have well-defined centrosomes. And the spindle is actually set up as a bipolar array before nuclear envelope breakdown.
Yeah.
And the chromosomes are packed. So that's a fundamental difference. And then in the abstracts, depending on whether or not they add centrosomes, just normally, you can get a different assembly pathway. So I would think that having centrosomes or not would already, it's an enormous difference in the nature of the spindle as well as the assembly pathway. And I assume that would affect every aspect, including length.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's interesting. I mean,
so the meiotic ones, which I guess are the, which ones are the meiotic ones?
These two black dots over here.
Yeah, so they're way off with respect to the, I mean, they just don't fit into the.
I mean, like, my intuition, which in some sense I think is a little bit depressing because I like spindle structure stuff, is that it's probably, and again, this could be totally wrong, is that really, like, everything has to do with kind of having the microtubules right so you kind of orient the spindle correctly. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, when you're meiotic, you basically have to just be near the surface so you don't need very long, you know what I mean? You know, like, I don't know, something like that, but, like, I don't know.
Just the blow-up graph here.
Yes.
The orange stage 8.
Yes.
Even in that stage, there's a crossover between the two types. So somehow it's not the cytoplasm, it's the sites that's really controlling.
Well, but not all stage 8 cells are. I mean, like, you know, like, you know, it doesn't. I don't think you can tell from something like that. I mean, because it could be, okay, so imagine there was some massive selective pressure to have this exact size, right? Then maybe you alter biochemistry such that you have exactly the perfect size, right? You know, I mean, and so by that argument, if that were the case, then just looking at the shape of this wouldn't tell you, right?
Is the nuclear diameter going down through mitosis as well as the cell diameter?
Yeah, and so I don't know the answer to that.
Right, and so how much through all these stages
what happens to the chromatin in the early stages? I have some vague recollection that DNA is much more fluffy, and then later on things sort of become much more rigid.
The meiotic chromosomes are highly condensed, much more so than the mitotic. Now, I would be surprised if, as this function of the cell cycle, a chromosome is going to go through as part of prophase, or condensed to a metaphase chromosome. And as far as I know, in terms of structure, there's none, they're always the same. And then it will be condensed, you know, recondensed. The only time that you would have a really differently condensed chromosome is in meiosis 1 and 2.
Does spindle length directly correlate to spindle mass?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. And so like with this type of data, it's basically not good enough to be able to do it because it's kind of immunofluorescence, and it's like, yeah, but that's a really interesting question. And so just very briefly, so it's not only true in frogs, also C. elegans, you kind of see a similar thing where in the first couple of divisions, you see that you have smaller and smaller spindles. And so there's kind of a recent paper where they argue that actually, not only do you have smaller spindles, but actually the centrosome size gets smaller and smaller. And so they argue that this is actually a causative for spindle length changes. I'm not necessarily saying, well, yeah, well, I'm just kind of saying about this. Yeah, that's what they say. Okay. So that's kind of just overall spindle structure. So I'm just going to just briefly talk about kind of differences in spindle dynamics and behaviors in different systems. And so obviously not a lot is known about this type of thing because, you know, there's only been a couple organisms where people have actually looked at them. But still, I'll just kind of just give people a sense of what's going on. So kind of, like I mentioned before, that microtubules turn over very, very rapidly. And so kind of one way which people measure this is the fluorescence recovery after photobleaching. So the experiment is that you have a spindle, in this case, frog egg extract one, where you have fluorescent tubulin. And then what you do is that you shine light and you bleach tubulin in a certain region and you look at the time it takes to recover from that bleach. And so this tells you about somehow the exchange rate. There are actually a huge number of problems with these type of experiments, but still, that's what I think it is. Say again? Oh, I mean, like, and so you can certainly worry about that you're actually damaging stuff and, you know, screwing stuff up, and also actually getting the bleach region, because, I mean, like, normally you don't really know what you're bleaching, basically. You can end up bleaching a lot of soluble stuff as well, and so you know what's going on, and then also, like, Yeah, right. I mean, and also, like, you can have artifacts if stuff can bind and unbind, you know, material which is here, so it's not, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it can be just very, very complicated, and it's not necessarily obvious how to relate what you see here to really microtubule behaviors. But
if you're... kinetics of binding and unbinding, you don't get motion dynamics.
Right, so but I don't know. I mean, like, you could
the basic thing is that it's thought that there's little or no exchange within the surface ladders, so that if you're bleaching and you have a bleach zone, you're going to have some sort of transport. So it all depends on, so everything would be totally artifactual if you're fracking and generated ends within that region, because then you wouldn't have to rely on as much transport. So that's another example.
I mean, in vitro, do you see that?
Well, and so certainly, like, and so, like, it's certainly really easy to generate wrong results with FRAP.
Oh, yeah. it's interpreted well, it's a robust technology.
Oh, no. I mean, it's one of many things that one needs to do. Yeah. No. I'm not saying it's like one should always ignore FRAP or something like that.
Single-mindedly fit it to next level.
No. I'm just saying there are caveats as well. Yeah.
So when you look at this kind of FRAP experiment, I mean, it's possible that, I mean, microtubules could be dynamically unstable and just dissolve, and then you get a bunch of fluorescent monomers dissolving there, and you get a bunch of background crap. And so I don't know when you talk about turnover, what type of, is it depolymerization of one at a time from the end of the microtubule, or is it just like complete collapse and dissolving?
And so I'm not entirely sure I understand the question, but like one possible answer, and even if this is an answer, is that, I mean, it's not clear whether there's any coordination between polymerization and depolymerization of individual microtubules within the spindle, which aren't kinetochore microtubules. It's not clear if those are kind of working independently or somehow working together or something like that.
But if you were talking about losing at the plus n, you would have single subunits and multiple subunits going cooperation, wouldn't you?
Depending
on the event.
Yes, when one guy goes, like the thought is that, there's a lot of evidence for that, like when an individual microtubule starts depolymerizing, it's a massive depolymerization where you have a huge number of subunits falling off.
But in that spot, you're looking at what, hundreds of microtubules?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so but if you just do frap on different organisms and look to see what results you get for turnover, you can see different numbers. And so, for example, in Pombe, people look frapped in the spindle and they get, depending on whatever, of order, 50 to 100 seconds. And then, different organisms, you can get down to, 10 seconds or less. And so there's variation in the speed of turnover, right?
Remind you, in frog extracts prepared from interphase, just like interphase cells, the microtubule dynamics are much slower, isn't that right?
Oh, that's right. No. This is stuff in the spindle. Yeah, exactly. This is stuff like in spindles. Yeah. Certainly it's very, strongly cell cycle dependent.
That suggests that you may be screwing things up by crafting, but nevertheless.
Oh, yeah. It's
cell states and dynamics.
Yeah. No, definitely. But the point is that it's not all the same, right? And so so that in itself, at least sometimes interesting. And so not only that, another thing is motion. So I was mentioning motion before. So and so here I'm showing this so I can show one thing which I actually did. and so this is a replication of the same type of experiment. Where now this is again in frog egg extracts. But instead of doing photoactivation, I was involved with, I guess, was so here we have a frog egg extract spindle actually. But instead of adding a lot of tubulin, we add so little fluorescent tubulin that by doing very good microscopy, you can visualize individual tubule molecules in the spindle, and you can watch how they move around, and you can do automated particle tracking to see, to analyze their motion in detail.
So those are single molecules?
Yes. Yeah.
How are you imaging it?
It's a spinning disk.
What's your signal above your background?
It's very high.
How?
Oh, I don't remember. I don't know. It's 20 or something like that.
What kind of camera are you using?
Yeah, this is an EMCCD.
Okay.
Thank you. right, and so again, in here you see the exact same type of thing, just to illustrate again, the spindle is basically constant size, but you have a huge amount of motion, right? And continual motion to the poles.
And where are the poles and where are they?
Oh, sorry. There's one pole here, chromosomes are basically here.
It's just saying that all the motion is going down, everywhere.
No. And so some guys, you choose some guy. There are some guys going down up here and some guys going up here, but if you choose some random guy, you can follow him going up or going down. Half and half? Oh, yeah, no, that's not true at all. Yeah.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that you're looking at a particular section, and two, it's an overlapping array. So if the chromosomes are in the middle, you're going to have two polarities around the middle.
But we can also get to spindle structure later.
The lower pole.
There's still guys going in both directions.
Yeah,
that's right.
What's the frame rate?
This is one frame every 2 seconds, basically.
So I'm a little bit confused why you see features for longer than 10 frames if all those frap measurements are.
Well, if you try to follow, no. If you look over the turnover in an individual guy, actually. So it's hard to follow individual. There's so many molecules here, you get confused. But a lot of what I did was looking at the statistics of binding and unbinding of individual guys, and it's totally consistent with the frap measurements.
Okay.
You
can see them vanishing, right?
You can definitely see them vanishing.
Yeah.
You see them reappearing.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I did was a lot of looking at the statistics of times between binding and unbinding and this type of stuff.
Can you extract an image from that?
Second, please.
Oh yeah.
Can you extract an image?
Like a palm image from it.
Like a palm image.
Yeah.
The thing is that obviously it's very dynamic, right? So one can certainly kind of average it all together, and then you see lines and stuff like that. But.
It's really nice.
Yeah. I wouldn't argue that this is a high resolution image or something like
that. Why not? That's what the palm people do.
Okay, that's an interesting point, but I still wouldn't argue that.
You're more
comfortable. I mean, I think there, yeah, right. I think there are a lot of problems with that.
Explain what's happening. Can you just like watch one of these? What's happening to it as it moves? When it disappears, what's happening?
Okay. So what the physical interpretation would be is that so basically there are all these microtubules here which we can't see. What happens is that you have a microtubule, a soluble tubule molecule binds to it. We can only see guys which are bound to the spindle because the guys who aren't bound to the spindle are diffusing around so fast that we can't see them. So a guy binds to the spindle, appears, you can see it. This microtubule is translocating in the spindle. That's the physical motion. It's the entire microtubule is being translocated. Then, and while it's being translocated, the microtubule is polymerizing, depolymerizing. When the microtubule eventually depolymerizes past where this monomer was, it falls off into solution again. And so it's, that's what the yeah.
How far away from your cover slip are you?
Yeah, so you have to be kind of close to the cover slip or else the imaging gets worse. This is, I don't remember, like, it's of order like 5 microns or something like that. Yeah.
So you're really looking at monomers.
That's correct.
And they can, so can they incorporate any place?
And so they incorporate the ends of microtubules, but they incorporate everywhere in the spindle. The ends of microtubules are everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yes, exactly.
Can you go lower, I believe, on the speckle that you have? Like, can you do even lower density of?
Oh, yeah.
And when do you get, can you track individual ones and get better at this? Because here it's 11 mesh, I believe.
No. You can do a very good job of tracking these things, but if you go lower, no. So like what I did is I went even lower and then just averaged even more spindles, and it's the same. Yeah.
You can track
like 10 times
more dense than this if you want to.
Yeah.
It's not a problem.
Okay.
You have to pay attention to those events, but it's not a problem.
Okay, but the point is that, okay, so with, okay, so like, all right, so the motion is very, very, very complicated, and it's hugely interesting, but like, I'm just saying that they're moving at a rate, 2 microns per minute, so it's much more complicated than this, but like, still, let's say that. And so in froggy HRFs, they move about 2 microns per minute. You can do other methods to say, like in plants, at least in some plants, you also have some speed which is around 2 microns per minute. In other systems, you have slower speeds, and as far as anyone can tell, there's absolutely none of this flux in other types of spindles. And so, like again, in these yeast spindles or in Cialdin's first mitotic spindle, there's none of it. And so this is, you know, interesting, right?
What do these times mean? I mean, I assume these things are all grown under different conditions and even different temperatures. I mean, normally a rat, kangaroo rat, kidney tissue would be in a mammal, I guess.
So that's correct. Yeah.
35 degrees.
Yeah, no. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So what would that 0.5 mean in terms of what it would be doing in a real world?
And so all I've done here is just taken numbers from literature. I'm not making any claims about anything beyond that besides, you know, I mean, because no one's done a good systematic study, and so, like, you know, this is all I can say right now.
Real organisms.
Is there any?
In the real world, would you actually be the same?
And so certainly, like, these numbers are temperature dependent and stuff like that, and presumably, you know, the happiness of the cell and all these other things. But what I think is undeniable is that in some organisms you have motion, in some organisms you do not. And so that, I think, there's no way around. Well, I haven't looked at these papers in detail, but like, I don't know. Yeah, I haven't looked at the papers in detail, so I don't really know the answer to that. But. Yeah, I mean, so I love the. Well, oh, no, I don't want to get into the biophysics stuff, but okay, yeah, no, let's just keep this here right now. Okay, and then okay, so now also difference in number of microtubules. Okay, so this is one of these frog egg extract spindles, like I was saying before. So what Peg did, who's a technician in Tim Mitchison's lab, is that she's done a bunch of EM studies on these spindles. And so basically take something like this, fix it, embed it in plastic, and then cut a section this way. So imagine I cut a section this way, rotate it out towards you, right? That's this image here, okay? So this is the cross section of a spindle. here is, these are chromosomes, these black things here. These black things over here are lipids which happen to be associated with the spindle, right? So I'm going to zoom into this little box here. And then I see this little box, or this bigger box. So chromosomes again. I'm going to zoom into this little box here. And what I see is this box. Chromosomes, and now I see these circles. These are microtubules which are pointing out toward you. So you see a little circle because of it going this way, right? So in this little box here, right, there are a lot of microtubules, right, in this box, and then in this box, and this box, right? So there are a lot of microtubules in these spindles. So in this cross section, there are of order 20,000 microtubules, okay? So this is for this, this is just one random cross section in, near the middle of the spindle, right? Okay, so. Yeah, yeah, and so that hasn't been done for these ones because these spindles are gigantic, and actually, like whatever this is technical, like the fixation procedure here isn't great. So like this wouldn't be the you wouldn't want to do it this way for here, but like people have done a lot of that type of work with other systems. But right, right, right. But okay, but I'll come back to this point in a moment. But like hold on, that's a really excellent thing. Well, I'll come back to that in a moment.
Associated lipids is an artifact of the way the extract works. You wouldn't expect these lipids to be associated with spindles.
So you often do have like lipids being associated with the spindle, and so like I don't know if that's kind of a functional thing, or how much of a functional thing that is, but it's true. Okay, so this is this Fragile extract spindle, right? That's a cross section of an entire yeast spindle, right? On the scale of this little image here. And so here, these are the individual microtubules, which you can kind of make out, right? But the point is that like this entire spindle is smaller than this one little box, right? Which is a vastly different number of microtubules. And then just for kind of like I don't know the sake of stuff. And so here's also a cross section of the center of a diatom spindle, which is more or less a similar scale. Where you can also see, again, just choose your different, sizes and stuff.
That's a dark scale.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't
want to. I was involved with this.
Okay, yeah.
But this, the diatom is unusual. It has a paracrystalline array of microtubules in the central spindle. And the microtubules basically run to the spindle midzone with a well-defined overlap. This is the most highly ordered spindle anyone has gotten their hands on in diatoms. So the black ones are coming from one fold, or the open they're just artificially colored. The other ones are coming from the other fold. And they retract from pole to pole. And you have a well-defined overlap zone. And then when they elongate, they slide. And the amount they slide is directly dependent on the overlap. And we demonstrated that by doing not only reconstruction, but also by actually getting isolated and getting the looking for.
So
these
muscling
pills? It's not known. There is kinase. This was done back a long time ago.
Yeah. Wait. So I'll just say briefly then. So like one can kind of get an order of magnitude estimate. So like I'd say, okay. So these numbers we're fairly sure of, right? Because like people have very good reconstructions and stuff. But like this is just I don't know. Like I'd argue kind of a half guess. So like in probably a frog egg extract spindle, maybe you have of order 100,000 microtubules. Kind of human tissue culture cells, I don't know, what are 10,000, or, I don't know, whatever. And then, yeast, 40, right? So vastly different number of microtubules.
What's the chromosome number in yeast again?
Cerevisiae, it would be 16. And in Pombe's, 3. At Cerevisiae, each chromosome has one microtubule attached to it, whereas in Pombe's, 2 or 3. And the number of microtubules in the central spindle is rather small. It's only it's less than 50%, so it's like in the order of 18 or 20. Whereas in the PTK1s, they're one rough less than a third of the microtubules are associated with chromosomes. And in Mulavus, I'm sure it's much less than that.
Yes, but I don't know, maybe like 5% of microtubules or something like that.
But the surprising thing is that if you take a diatom and you take the central spindles, that's to say the ones not the chromosome attached ones is way outside, you can't track them because they're going like this. There, just about every microtubule is almost practically the same one, within 10%. Whereas, if you take a PTK1 or a HeLa cell, or I assume Cynthus labels, then you have a mixed distribution. So you have a bunch of them that run So you have two things to consider. One is the polarity relative to poles, because the poles are nucleating minus N1s, and then you're going to be running towards the center. And then you see, but the thing that's interesting in these guys is that not all of my microtubules are on the poles. Either they were nucleated elsewhere, or they broke off, matter of debate, or you have bad fixation. All could contribute. And in the yeast, on the other hand, there's enormous, at the very beginning, then the overlap is enormous, and the chromosome runs from one pole to the other. You know? And then as they elongate, then they're both growing, and the overlap increases.
Yeah, so this is kind of like in lab. Okay, so this is, so these are just, again, like two, I'm going to show some other spindles in a second, but like this is a tomographic reconstruction, so this is kind of, you know, like a better way of doing the EM, or I don't know, it's all good. But, and so this is just to show, again, like, so now we have like real three-dimensional, so like, you know, for yeast, for both, yeah, for like budding yeast, for example, you know, you can do a full reconstruction of the entire spindle where you know everything. The number of spindles where that's done is actually very few. And so like, I personally would argue that I think like, in order to really understand the biophysics of what's going on, we really need, so for example, if you were to ask what's the length distribution of microtubules like in kind of, you know, like a Leva spindle, we don't know. And so like, I mean, I can kind of give guess based on stuff, but we don't rigorously know. And even for human spindles, we don't know. So this is a kind of a partial reconstruction of a mitotic skeleton spindle, where again you can just see like where the microtubules are. This isn't all the microtubules because it's only a partial reconstruction, but it's, you know, whatever, clearly very different. Yeah, that's a chromosome. And so these are essentially microtubules which contact these white microtubules are microtubules which contact the chromosome. You know, like in this section of the reconstruction, and the red ones.
This is a holocentric chromosome, so they don't have attachment. They don't have a point or a regional centromere. They have attachment sites all along the line, and there's no obvious structure. So you can't tell from these images whether or not it actually is inserted into a holocentric kinetic core or whether it's just going by.
Okay, and then another. And another thing, just to show, and this is getting back to the talk before, is that, you know, the spindle structure can be quite different. And so, as far as people can tell, so there's not been a real reconstruction of the first mitotic spindle, so in skeleton. So again, we don't know how long microtubules are and stuff like that. But as far as anyone can tell, all the microtubules have their minus ends, you know, one of their ends at the pole, right? That's not true for skeleton's meiotic spindle. So like, if you just look at some random place and do reconstruction, you see both plus and minus ends basically spread everywhere. So these meiotic spindles, you have essentially a bunch of short microtubules, and here short, I mean like how long? I don't know, because it's just some very small partial reconstruction where a lot of the microtubules are going, you know, through the volume, so you don't know the actual length distribution. But essentially short microtubules where both plus and minus ends are spread throughout the entire spindle. Where this microtubule is essentially long microtubules, where all, as far as people can tell, all the minus ends end at the centrosome. So very different organization.
In both cases, they don't have flex.
So no one's looked here. But yeah. So for example, and this gets back to like what is flux, and so like it's not, and so this is whatever this is. I'll just mention 2 seconds this because it's kind of a biophysical thing, not. But so like it's unclear. So like there's this observation that tubulin is moving, right? But mechanistically, what's going on? And so the classic interpretation is that individual microtubules are treadmilling. That is that you have an individual, any given microtubule is polymerizing at one end and depolymerizing at the other end, and so it's turning over, right? So, and that's what most people would argue is the case. Personally, I do not think that's what's going on, but I'm in the minority. I think what's going on is that you have short microtubules which are physically being translocated as they essentially more or less turn over at one end, but like.
How does that first one, the treadmilling, how does that explain speckle movement?
No, so that explains speckle movement because you have a microtubule, so imagine I have a microtubule of this fixed length, so, and a guy adds here and always falls off here, then any given spot will kind of move through because you're always adding on. So imagine I have a fluorescent guy. Oh, yeah, and then you have motors who are keeping. So you also need motors to keep the physical, you know, kind of microtubule where it is as guys go through. So it's some balance.
I see. So there's like, it's like a gliding
Yeah.
An assay, and you're looking at.
Exactly, exactly. So that's what the vast majority of people in the field think.
Yeah.
But I disagree.
Assuming structure that I need to pour in it.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
So you have two different assembly pathways in synthesis, depending whether or not you add a centrosome. So if you add centrosomes or not, right?
I would argue against that. I mean, like, and so I would argue.
I was wondering whether if you had if you have centrosomes present versus absent in the flex stress, would you have more short microtubules or longer ones?
In the Laevis extract, if you add centrosomes, they really don't do much at all. And so really centrosomes kind of like sit around, they have a couple of microtubules going off of them, they kind of hang out at the poles, but they don't really do much.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I would argue that they really aren't doing anything in the extract.
So they're not kind of affecting the distributional length.
I don't believe so. What my prediction would be, and no one's done this, is that like, so here you see these massive afterscriptors are all coming from centrosomes. Here you don't have centrosomes and you don't have, you know, esters, right? It's not just the presence or absence of centrosomes, but other factors which would be activating things and like, yeah.
The lengths, one that has all the short ones doesn't have doesn't have centrosomes that are defined.
That's correct.
I wonder if that was related.
For example, your point previously that like, and so, and again, this is pure speculation, but I could imagine that, let's say, sometimes you build spindles out of short microtubules, in which case you still have to have them bi-oriented. So perhaps by having them flow past each other by motors, you can essentially bi-orient them, right? Well, in these type of cases, you know, you're kind of bi-oriented already, right? Because you just have esters, right? So in some sense, it's you know, different.
So from your experiments, could you get these length statistics of the microtubules?
No, because, I mean, all you can do is essentially you can look at motion of guys and turnover. But like, if it was treadmilling, and literally it was a guy peers, goes through and falls off the other end, then you could get length statistics. But if you have anything else, then
you can't separate the two.
That's right. And also, I mean, like, again, this is getting into biophysics stuff, but like, but myosins tend not to depolymerize or do anything. Actually, if you like, cut the spindle and you generate new myosins, and then they're totally static. They don't like, I don't know. But again, that's later.
Is there a correlation between having this flux and the fact that you have LFSA? Because in CLA, you have LFSA.
Okay, I don't know. As far as I know, the only things which people have seen, which are sure don't flux, are, you know, fission yeast, budding yeast, and first mitotic C. elegans. As far as I know, those are the only things. But that's not, you know, I mean, people haven't, say, looked very broadly, right?
So we in this direction, I mean, it's too detailed, but the generic of fibers are flexing or not as well?
Okay, so this is a really interesting question. So, like, so everyone would say, yes, they're fluxing. You have polymerization of, microtubules at kinetic or depolymerization at the poles, right? So, like, I myself would argue that we don't really know what the dynamics of kinetic or microtubules are like. Because the problem is, what I would argue is that by light microscopy, if you see by EM, there's so many microtubules there that if you look at anything by light microscopy, you don't know what, you know, you don't know what you're looking at. I mean, there's microtubules in any given volume, there's microtubules which are kinetic or non-kinetic, so it's very hard to disentangle this. So I would argue that we don't really know, but. But again, like, you know, like in full disclosure, that like I'm probably the only person who believes that. So.
That's okay.
My last question is in direction. So when in the photoactivation experiments, it's a straight line which remains straight as it moves.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
You mean everything is synchronized, or how does that?
I mean, sometimes you do see curvature and stuff of the line, but often it's just straight and keeps going. It's also, I mean, like, I don't know if this is synchronized or just that there's the average velocity in this, you know, in this in the perpendicular direction is constant. Which is true when you look microscopically, but like, and yeah.
It is also from the spectrum you also see that.
Well, again, I mean, like, the average is constant. Yeah, and so, like, if as you get to the poles, actually, things slow down. But.
If the minus ends are very stable, as you were saying, would you see some persistent more persistent ones, the ones that were at the minus ends?
And so you're saying, like, if
there wasn't treadmill,
oh, and so I mean, what I meant that my, again, this is my personal interpretation, and it's not at all this is correct, is that basically most of the microtubules in the spindle are turning over by plus n dynamics, and so sometimes, and so the plus n can depolarize all the way, and if you get rid of these guys, but I personally believe that there's, I mean, you know, maybe there is some, but there's very little dynamics on the other end.
Then there would be a variation in like the turnover rate among the sort of the gamma.
Well, it depends what you mean in some sense. And so, like, if you have a pre-existing microtubule and you ask, given I have a microtubule this length, how much does this guy turn over? That's one question. Another question is, imagine I have a small microtubule. You know, I mean, like, you know, another question is that, is it really length dependent? You know, does a microtubule kind of know how long it is, right? And so some people argue that there is length dependence of microtubule dynamics, but that's not kind of really rigorously shown. Yeah.
Very last questions. In that movie that you made, with the individual monkey. This is general, but all the microtubules in a given, attached to a given section, right, they're all pointing in the same direction.
Well, so remember, like I was saying, so I believe that this type of spindle is like the C. elegans meiotic spindle, where it's a lot of short microtubules. I mean, this hasn't been shown by EM, but I and other people as well believe that by, you know, just indirect light microscopy measurements, that the spindles are very similar. And it's true, like, if you look even also, I mean, so it's not just a question of meiotic spindles, because, like, if you look at this kind of PTK2 reconstructions, it seems like there are also a minus n spread throughout, you know, as mentioned previously.
But there's a gradient.
It's not.
I mean, as you get closer to the centrosome, there'll be more n's.
Right.
But basically, they don't all end on the same.
Right, exactly.
But in the direction they're pointing is they're spread through the direction they're pointing.
So polarity is all the same, because there have been polarity measurements made on PTK1 spindles. So you find mixed polarities where they're in the middle,
right,
but towards each pole, then they're not.
Okay, right. So this is just mentioned previously. Is that, and again, just so that was kind of non-kinetical microtubules, and kinetical microtubules is also a huge variation. So again, you know, in budding yeast, you have like about one microtubule per kinetic core. In fission yeast, you have about three. In kind of a lot of tissue culture systems, you have a, you know, about 20 per guy. In holocentric guys like C. elegans, I actually don't know how many microtubules you have, but I'm just kind of randomly guessing hundreds, but I don't know if that's correct. But it's a large variation.
Well, the other thing that's interesting, of course, is that the distribution is different on the meiotic versus the
meiotic. Okay, this.
The meiotics are only in the two inverted regions.
Okay.
Okay. And then in the meiotic, we go back to the poles and we suppress a lot of along the length of the arm. The viruses wouldn't work if people were all attached all like from the meiotic.
Okay, right.
So is this a physical thing that's necessary? I mean, I guess an average human chromosome must be about, 100 times the size of a yeast chromosome.
Well, this is a really interesting question. I mean, so, like, if you just ask, you know, like, how much force, and again, this was kind of mentioned previously, how much force does it take to move a chromosome in cytoplasm, kind of assuming some reasonable viscosity for cytoplasm, basically one molecular motor could do it. It's not a problem, right? And so the issue isn't kind of force generation in some absolute sense, but it's how do you get guys to go where they should go? I mean, having said that, I mean, in the context of the spindle, it could be very different, right? Because there, it's not just free cytoplasm. You have all these other microtubules around and stuff like that.
The other thing is that you might have a factor of 4 or 5, even in the same karyotype, of the size of the chromosomes. But the kinetic cores, essentially, all, for any one species, are all roughly the same size. So in a PTK1 cell, its chromosomes are 2 or 3 times larger than the kinetic core. I mean, what's limiting is the size of the kinetic core in its organization, not the chromosome size.
Okay. So that was all. Now I'm just going to say a couple of random things.
There must be only so many microtubules.
Yeah, it limits the number of microns. So now you can see there are some beasts that have huge metachores and some that have smaller ones and stuff. So what I would argue is that it's sort of species, I mean, species specific, but it's not chromosome specific. So the HeLa cells have metachores that are roughly 25 plus and minus 4 or 5. It's independent of which chromosome. It's not the lower chromosomes that have half the number that have. There are some species that have enormously large metachores.
So are there cases where kinetochores might be organized in several planes? Like, I mean, not in living systems, but in vitro experiments. Can that observe?
Well, I'm sorry, what do you mean by several planes?
I mean, just one plane where you have kinetochores in the other plane. Spindle. But you have two, three.
So you're saying like you know, could you have some line up in the middle, some line up two thirds in the way, and some line up,
right,
something like this?
And some red.
Well, okay. What I didn't mention is that actually some organisms don't have like a metaphase plate at all. So you never have this stage where guys congress to the middle and then you know like go.
So the point is if you have just. The way I think about it is if you have two sisters, you have two kinetochores, they normally face in opposite directions, one attached to either pole. And then by accident, so you have a variety of accidents. These are mostly seen in meiotic cells where it's easier to manipulate, and the kinetochores are floppy because in meiotic cells, the kinetochores are usually cups as opposed to the plates. But you can get what they call an ameroteric attachment, which is the same kinetochore, the microtubules, instead of facing one like this, it can be sort of sideways, you have microtubules facing each pole. But usually, that is unstable, and that's broken. But there are situations where it isn't, and then that totally screws everything up. So the normal configuration is one kinetochore, one pole, one the other, and there are even proteins, except at meiosis one, where the two sisters, both kinetochores fuse together or not, or side by side and point to the same pole, and there are proteins that control that. And if you make any mistake in that, then that's serious. And you can, for example, if you do cold shock and recovery of microtubules, in a cold shock experiment, the way they're interpreted is that the microtubules depolymerize and repolymerize, and you actually have short fragments left that can nucleate, and then you can screw up the orientation. And you see errors, but usually they're corrected. And what happens is that the metaphase to anaphase transition, that delay in the line of the middle is the time when you correct errors like that.
Yeah, but let's say I could rephrase my question. I did the project. If you have a Diplodocus extract and you prepare two of this, you know, bichloro.
Yes.
And you bring them close together.
Yes. Oh, so people have done this. This is a beautiful experiment. So, like, you have two of these guys come together, and so what happens is that so let's say you push them together like this, right?
Right.
They fuse to form one spindle with all the guys aligned in the middle, and the amount of microtubules you have in the end is basically more or less the same as what you had in any one of the other ones.
Okay, but they never stop.
No, they don't stop. They don't stop or anything like that, right? And then also, yeah, and then you can, yeah, whatever. Yeah, so it's a very cool experiment, but yeah. No, there's no pause or anything.
Like in C. urchinics, if you screw up the cell cycle and then start up again, you can get eggs with multiple poles. And so what happens if you get a tripolar situation. And what you get is something that sort of looks like a reverse Mercedes-Benz signal. So these are classic experiments that were done in the third by Dan Medizia and other people. So you get, let's say you have three poles. What you actually get is three, you get spindles like this. And the chromosomes get distributed like this or this.
Right, so that's different from what one sees in cancer cells when you have three poles.
No, this is the sea urchin thing, right. where you can shock it and get multiple poles.
Well, in cancer cells, sometimes you have three poles, in which case you have a configuration like this.
Well, they may also, but the point is that you never get a chromosome that somehow goes like that. The chromosomes distributed between the two poles.
No. One thing.
What I was saying, even in this situation, if you're looking at any one chromosome, it's oriented like this. It's never
right.
Mm-hmm. It's still each individual chromosome is bipolar.
Yeah. No, but that, okay. So I was asking whether you could have that in one dimension.
Yeah. No. So I've never. I don't think
so
that's seen.
Yeah. Or two dimensions.
But one thing, just this is totally, you know, apropos of nothing, but like very cool is that, so like in some cases you see these, and in some cases you see guys like these, right? You know, where you have four poles where you kind of screw up stuff because, you know, cancer cells get really screwed up. And then what you can do sometimes, there are things you can inhibit which like reduce the number of poles. And so you can go from like, you know, so like sometimes if you have a lot of tripoles, you can inhibit something which then gives you a lot of bipoles. And then you inhibit it more, then you get a lot of monopoles.
And something is not A5.
And like A5 is one of these, and there are other things, yeah.
So we should try and wrap up.
Okay, yeah.
Fewer questions, but we can always keep the discussions going later.
Yeah, no. Okay. So I'll just say kind of two more things and I'm done. And so what I'm saying is that there's just two things which I think are cool. So one is that, so there's a variation molecular process. So there are a lot of mitotic kinesins, which are obviously hugely important, right? But none of these are universally conserved across all organisms. And so kinesin 5, right? If you knock this out of, again, human cells, then you see monopoles. But there are, you know, some organisms which don't have kinesin 5. You know, kinesin 13, if you knock that out of human cells, you see like huge, bushy, it's a total mess, but there's some organs that don't have kinesin 13. But another thing is, at the same time, inhibiting specific kinesins across organisms can sometimes lead to very similar phenotypes. So if you knock the kinesin 5 in plants or in human cells, you see monopoles or spindles either way. So that's kind of cool. And then I'll just mention just this last thing. And then also, like, for example, so the other motor, which is, you know, so there's two classes of microfilm motors. There's kinesins and there's dynein. And dynein is also super important for, you know, spindle formation, but flowering plants don't have dynein, but they have spindles fine. And then another thing which I'll just mention which I think is really interesting, because this RAN pathway, which is involved in nuclear import, ends up to be very important for spindle assembly in a number of systems. And so it's kind of really interesting that you have this RAN pathway, you know, I don't know. Using both continents.
For closed
mitosis
or even for open?
For open. So this is not a nuclear import function. It's actually involved in the regulation of microtubule nucleation by using, in some sense, the same biochemical mechanism. I mean, so this isn't true in all spindles. I'm done.
Oh, that was
okay.